Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you wildlife facts, conservation updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. We all know what corals are and we all know what they do. But do we really know? I certainly didn't, it turns out. But with the help of this week's guest, marine coral scientist and PhD student Rosie Steinberg, I now know so much more, and in approximately 40 minutes time, so will you. Rosie and I dived into the world of corals, learning how they develop, the relationships they have with other animals and organisms, and the wonderful things they do to pretty much help the entire planet. You'll definitely come away with a newfound love and a huge respect for these weird and delicate creatures. So thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hello Rosie, welcome to Into the Wild. It's lovely to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, Ryan. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, really cool. We're going to be talking about corals today, which I'm really excited about. First of all, you're in Sydney, Australia. So what time is it there for you?
It is just after 9 in the morning right now.
Just after 9. And it is currently 10 o'clock at night here. So we're at the opposite ends of the spectrum. Although probably still I'm having a tea and you're probably having a coffee.
I'm actually having a nice kombucha.
See, we've got this wrong. You should be having a tea and I should be having a kombucha right now. We've got them the wrong way around. It's a pleasure to meet you, meet you on Zoom, and I'm looking forward to chatting today. For the listeners, do you want to tell us who you are and what is it you do?
Yeah, I'm Rosie Steinberg. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of New South Wales, and I'm studying New South Wales soft corals, which has been a really cool and interesting experience. And I'm in my last year, so I've just collected all my data and I'm just getting things written up now, which is pretty nice.
We don't like to talk about lockdown too much on Into the Wild, but how has that been, considering it's been your last year, how has it affected you too much? Did you manage to get all the data you needed?
I was very lucky that I got my last big field trip done right before.
Awesome.
Anything kind of went down. So it did slow me down in the laboratory a little bit because we couldn't go in. But now things are pretty normal in Australia, except that, you know, everyone's spaced out in lines. Beyond that, everything's open. Everything's pretty clear. So it's been nice.
I think I speak on behalf of every British person right now when I say we're jealous. We are back in lockdown. So cheers to that.
Cheers.
We raise our kombucha and our English breakfast tea at 10 p.m. at night. Right, let's get back to the question. Second question for you, Rosie, is everyone that I talk to on the show is a massive fan of wildlife and nature, but how for you did your love for wildlife and nature begin?
I was always kind of an outdoors child. I always had my fingers in the mud. I was always bringing like weird critters home and keeping them as pets. I definitely picked up spiders that could have done me damage and took them to my mom a few times.
Really?
I had a pet scorpion that was only rarely fatal that I found in the backyard. That was fun.
Wait. Okay, hold that. Wait, pause. What spiders were you picking up?
As a little kid, apparently at one point I took my mom a black widow in my cupped hands.
What?
They're very gentle and docile.
I mean, fair point.
I was fine.
To the listeners, please do not pick up black widow spiders. And what was the scorpion that you had as a pet? Was this a wild one that you kind of like, you know, bug collecting?
Yeah, so I grew up in the southwest of the US in the desert. So we have a lot of really interesting, like really, really cool and interesting bugs. And my parents had a rule that anything I brought home I could keep for a week and then it had to go back.
That's a good rule.
It was pretty good. So I'd find a whatever, and after the original picking things up with my hands, I did start using containers. So I did not pick up the scorpion, but it was fun. Like you'd take them, you'd put them in a little like critter keeper and look up what they are and what they, you know, what their habitats were and why you'd found them, where you'd found them. And that was kind of my first look into figuring out what was around me, which I really liked. But my dad was always really into aquariums, and he got me really into aquariums. And that's where my love of marine science began, because I grew up in a desert. I wasn't anywhere near the ocean, but my dad he's got over 1,000 gallons of salt water in his basement right now.
Wow.
So the basement is the aquarium central, and there's a lot of aquariums in there. So that's where I started learning about fish and about corals and those sorts of things.
So when you said I feel like you, when you said your dad was really into the marine, I feel like you underplayed that until we found out he had 1,000 gallons of tanks in his basement.
He's really, really, really into aquariums.
Into that's better. That's a good emphasis on the word really there. That's incredible. What does he have in them?
So he's got 4 different big tanks. They're all coral tanks. But like he'll have one for like corals that like this sort of lighting, and some for the like some for shallow water corals that like bright light, and some for deeper water corals that like darker lights. And then you can have things in different layers. And he does keep fish, but the fish he keeps are only ones that are good for the corals. He's really he's got them for the corals.
He's got those cleaner fish in there.
Yeah, he's like, if it eats algae or it eats parasites off the corals, it can come in. Otherwise, nah. No. And 1 clownfish for little kids.
He's spoken like every aquarist I think I've ever met.
They definitely love their corals. And I don't have salt water right now, which is sad, but I do have some very fancy betas, which I love.
That's incredible. It's so understanding that you have gone into this world of corals and soft corals, if that's what your dad's done. I can't go over that 1,000 gallons of tanks. I think that's like the size of the aquariums I was working in when I was in my animal management career. So let's move on to corals. Now, I was going to say, how did you get interested in them? That was my question. But obviously, finding about how your dad, what your dad's interests are, that's very evident. But let's ask the question then. What keeps you interested about corals?
They're just so weird and alien. Like, it's interesting. They're an animal, but they're an animal that can photosynthesize, which is really weird. So they're like, a lot of people, when they see them, they're like, is it a rock? Is it a plant? Is it an animal? And it's kind of all of them. And that weirdness really keeps me going. That and just everything that lives in them is really amazing.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's a really good way of saying that. Before we get into the world of corals, I guess for you personally, there must be loads of different species, but do you have a favorite type of coral?
Yeah, there's a lot of corals. I'm really into, I love all corals, but the ones that I'm most interested are the non-tropical corals. So there's corals here, right here in Sydney. It's called the cauliflower soft coral. It's hot pink. They range from like baby Barbie pink to hot pink. And they're massive. Nice. And they look like a hot pink cauliflower. And I just love them. They're beautiful. They're weird. And they're one of my study species, so that's convenient.
Very convenient. And do you have a favorite reef that you like to, would love to go to, have been to before?
My favorite that I have been to is probably Lord Howe Island.
Where's that?
So it's just off the east coast of Australia. So it's part of Australia. And it's a teeny, teeny, tiny island. And it's got this, it's kind of shaped like a sea. And the inside of a sea is this big lagoon. And the lagoon is shallow and sheltered and gorgeous. And it's full of coral. And it's full of sea turtles and sharks and massive fish, and it's just the most beautiful and amazing place. I would recommend going. It is very expensive. I went on someone else's dime for research.
Is there any research project I can get in on that I could just be there for, like, I'm here for the lols?
Oh, I wish I could again. Everything's all shut down for there still. But I'll let you know if I go back.
Yeah, give me a shout, mate. I'll pop right over. Okay, so let's talk about corals, because I think for me, like I said to you before we recorded, I've done a very, very brief bit of work with corals, not a lot, but enough to learn the basics. But I'm aware that not everyone will know a lot of this, because I feel like even though a lot of nature documentaries might explore corals, we don't really go into enough detail about what they are and how they work. So let's put this simply. What are they?
So they are an animal.
Cool.
The basic rock, plant, or animal question is animal. But what's really interesting about them is that they're related to things like jellyfish. So they, when they're babies, they free swim and they pulse like a jellyfish.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really cool. If you can find videos on YouTube. If you just like search coral spawning, you can find really cool videos. And what they do is they kind of land on a rock and start building a little bit of like that's a hard coral, they'd be able to build a little bit of a calcium mound, like a little bit of rock.
Mm.
And if they're a soft coral, they build like a little fleshy, like the tip of your finger, a little fleshy thing. And then they start cloning themselves. So that one polyp that landed turns into two polyps, turns into four polyps. And that slowly starts building up an animal. And some of them can photosynthesize, like I said before. But they do this by taking algae from the water column and the sand and everything around them and putting them into their own bodies. And then they provide shelter and like fertilizer for the algae, and the algae provide sugar for the coral. And so they have this really beautiful symbiosis.
That's probably one of the most delicate symbiosis I think I've ever heard.
It's very delicate. And well, that's you know, part of the reason that a lot of corals and reefs are under threat is because it is a very delicate symbiosis and system.
Yeah, that's amazing. And like you said there, they just clone themselves. How does that, I mean, okay, idiot brain here. How does a polyp just clone itself?
I've not studied exactly how they do it, but many will, like other creatures like anemones, will literally, like, they'll start off like a big donut. They're like, they've got a ring of tentacles on the outside of the donut, and then the donut hole is the mouth with all the guts inside.
Yeah.
And so they'll literally pinch it off until they're like an eight, a figure eight, and then split apart. So you can actually watch that with anemones. If anyone's kept, especially the bubble tip anemones in aquariums, they're very prolific splitters. But they can also split by making a little bud off the bottom of it. So I've not seen exactly how that works, but...
It sounds... But as you said that, though, with a figure of eight, that is kind of how you would imagine it to happen as well. Just kind of... They literally just do it. They just do it.
Yeah, they just split.
I guess we won't ask too many questions. So the bony plates, if we look at hard corals, you said they form kind of a calcium hard plate. How is that formed from just a little polyp as well?
So they actually, like, pull calcium out of the water. Calcium carbonate. So and carbon... And then they start laying it down. I'm not sure exactly how they get all the different shapes that they do when they do this, but it's just those, they've got specialized cells that just secrete and put down that like layer of concrete of calcium and carbon.
And that helps them then to, so that is essentially a skeleton, and that helps them to kind of grow and become more successful as a coral, the bigger they can get, right?
Yeah, so some species of corals kind of aim for, you know, going up and out, which is what we think of when we think of tropical corals. And especially photosynthetic corals like that, because then you have more branches or surface area for light to hit.
Yeah.
But I actually really love non-photosynthetic corals. So not all of them do take in that algae. So like my favorite coral, the cauliflower soft coral, doesn't. And that's also why it's hot pink. Because most corals that have algae are algae colored. So they're going to be brown or green or maybe a little blue or a little orange. But the ones that don't have algae come in like a full rainbow of colors. And a lot of them, they care more about getting food because they need to eat. And so they'll do these like flat mats that spread outwards, or make like, the soft corals will make like a big bushy thing, or like just like a long stick, just something that can go into the current and trap any kind of particles that are going through.
Oh, that's so interesting. So they actually, in a way, get like the softer corals, or I'm sure other corals might do this as well, but actually capture their food, their whatever nutrients is floating by.
Yeah, so all corals can technically eat. They've all got, each polyp has a little mouth and a digestive system, but photosynthesis,
so small,
they're teeny tiny. And it's also, you can,
that's so, so small.
And well, some of them, some have big mouths, so especially some deeper corals will be like, a polyp can be, you know, 5 or 6 centimeters across, and they can eat like a big thing. But most corals have very itty bitty mouths, so they're eating like teeny, teeny, tiny crustaceans, because they've got stinging cells like an anemone or like a jellyfish. They're just not as strong unless you touch a fire coral, and then they're very strong.
So these, their life, they're kind of, how I'm picturing these now are, I'm picturing like an anemone, very similar, but a lot smaller, like you said, like very, very tiny, but in their lifestyle, like their lifestyle, that's such a human way of describing it, is, very similar to these kinds of animals.
Yeah, so they're all in the same basic group, and they live in similar ways. They have slightly different like favorite places to live or different foods, but the basics are very similar.
And how old can they actually like be or get to, or do they have a set lifespan, an average lifespan per species?
I don't know if there's any that we know have an exact lifespan. Like, we don't know that they have a lifespan the way a mammal would, because a lot of what they do is they can clone. And so each new clone, like, okay. How do you measure a lifespan on something that can clone itself?
If
the original polyp is dead.
Good point.
Is like, but there's some colonies that we know are several thousand years old. Some of the very large, massive boulders.
Wow.
They'll be the size of like a minibus, just massive.
Of what one type of coral?
Yeah.
Original from one.
Yeah, like from one original settled polyp, they'll just make these massive boulders.
Jesus.
But those grow super slowly. And so they're very, you know, growing slowly and living a long time tend to be paired in nature. And then there's...
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
And there's other corals that grow really, really quickly. Like the staghorn corals are the ones that if you see, you know, videos of people scuba diving in the Great Barrier Reef or in Hawaii, you see these amazing fingers of coral coming up. And those grow really fast, but are also more sensitive and they tend to die quickly as well. So they kind of have this high turnover rate.
Okay. So it really does vary between.
Yeah, it varies quite a bit.
And we kind of mentioned the word species before, but and you might not be able to answer this, but do we have any idea how many species of coral there are?
So from trying to figure out which species of coral I'm working on, I'm going to say that our estimate is way too low. There are for sure thousands and thousands. But corals are really hard to identify to species. There's a lot of contention on whether, you know, you have two corals that look identical. And then if you do genetic analysis, you're like, these are super different. And so it's just really hard to tell what is and what isn't a species. So that's been an interesting journey of trying to figure out what species I'm actually working on.
Do you ever get to the point with animals like coral where you go, do you know what? It doesn't matter how many species. Let's just save the damn things.
That's a lot of, the other thing that people do is they'll be like, you know what? I'm not going to worry about species. They're like, I've got three corals that are branching and I've got three corals that make a boulder and that's what I'm going to deal with.
Let's keep this simple. We haven't got time to waste with finding out what relates to what. Like,
yeah, and definitely people, especially for if you're looking at how the corals function as, say, habitat for animals, what's more important than what species it is usually what kind of shape it makes. So that's so they're called functional traits because it's what we can define by how they function, basically. So we know that, if it's got, you know, branches, it's going to be better home for little fish. If it's a big boulder, then you're going to find like tube worms and little crabs and crustaceans living in holes in it.
Yeah.
That's the more important, often the more important thing for ecology. Though I still think it's going to be, there are people out there untangling this massive web of what corals is what species. And I think that's going to be really, really important to find out so that we really have an idea of what we have now. But it's definitely, we're still in the untangling phase.
Yeah. I admire what you just said there because for the listeners, they wouldn't have seen this. But when you said, and that's a very important part, your face was like, I don't want to get involved in it.
I do not.
You were like,
there,
people can do that. That's fine. But I'm out. I checked out of that a long time ago. So we mentioned briefly about what they eat. So you said like tiny crustaceans and things. What kind of food are we looking at for a coral?
Oh, they eat lots and lots of stuff. So some soft corals will eat like microscopic algae in the water because they've got very, very small mouths.
Cool.
But most are pretty carnivorous. Most corals are pretty carnivorous. So they eat lots of crustaceans. A large coral can eat fish. I had a coral in a fish tank eat an anemone fish. That was tragic. and unexpected.
Is that such a dark world of the corals? I've never thought about that from a coral before.
Yeah, they're definitely predators. But a lot of them also eat marine snow, which tends to be a lot of debris and just like nutrients that are in the water column that aren't necessarily alive. But it is, you know, it's bits of protein, it's bits of carbohydrates, it's bits of fats that they can ingest. And this is especially true in deeper corals. So if anyone wants to check out deep sea corals, if they search Schmidt Ocean Institute on YouTube. They have highlights of some of their deep sea remote operated vehicle dives. And you can see some of these really amazing deep sea soft corals. And you'll see they're usually like on the side of a cliff pointing out. And that's because they're trying to get themselves as far into the current as possible and get as much food as they can.
Yeah, that's amazing. And also sea snow is a lot more of what I thought corals ate. That's the description I thought, rather than these predators that could eat fish. I was like, sea snow sounds like something corals would eat. Yeah, they just don't sound like predators.
They're not very effective predators or very efficient, but they'll do it. If something sits still long enough, they're going to eat it.
Yeah, I guess it's the way of the animal kingdom, isn't it? Like, they're not going to mess around. On the flip side, does anything eat them?
Oh, they're a huge part of the food chain, especially in tropical reefs. There's butterfly fishes that literally only eat coral and will not eat anything else.
Oh, wow.
So they are definite, but they've got a lot of defense mechanisms, but they are a big food source. So it's that same kind of evolutionary arms race you get between, say, like herbivores and plants, where the plant doesn't want to get eaten, so it starts making some kind of toxic compound or grows spikes or gets taller, and then the animal evolves along with it to be able to still eat that. So a lot.
Okay, cool, gotcha.
So a lot of corals, you know, they're hard, they're mucousy. Soft corals especially make tons of toxic compounds, and they smell terrible, but things still love to eat them, so.
I was just going to say about soft corals, you can imagine why, like the corals with the bony plates, you can imagine how they defend themselves, but soft corals, I was just going to ask, how do they do that? But they just smell absolutely rotten.
Oh yeah, they smell really, really bad. But they also, some of them, like the cauliflower soft coral, is in a genus called Dendronephthia, and a lot of them, so what soft corals, they have, they're just like fleshy and they don't have a solid bone. So it's like having a finger with no bone in it. So you can imagine that would be very floppy and not very easy to keep upright into a current, say.
Yeah.
So instead they have teeny tiny calcium crystals that they dot around the outside and sometimes the center of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And some species will use those also as defense. So the Dendronephthias, those are very sharp. They're like little razor needles.
Oh, cool.
So that's a second defense mechanism, is just having those super, super sharp. But not every species does that. A lot of them will just have like little round blunt, and they're called spicules or sclerites.
Wow, that's quite an in-depth defense system. What kind of nutrition? Because you said some species are... What was a fish that just eats coral?
So there's quite a few butterfly fish. One of my favorites that's pretty... There's so many. I'm trying to remember what the name of... All right, I'm just going to describe it because I've forgotten its name. There's one that's got orange and black stripes, and they're just... It's just the most beautiful... big round fish.
Should I Google it? Not a filefish.
Some filefish also do eat coral. They love it. Catadon speculum.
Oh, what's that common name?
I'm going to find him. The mirror butterfly fish.
Mirror butterfly fish. So these are types of fish that will eat. And are these hard corals or soft corals that these would be eaten?
They usually eat both. So the mirror butterfly fish, just found him. He's bright yellow with a big black stripe through his eye and a black dot up near his butt. They're just,
wow,
they're
striking.
So gorgeous. Another one that's, it's popular in aquariums because they won't eat just coral, but they do like to eat coral, is the copper band butterfly fish. And that one's just they're really pretty. They're got kind of a pearly white base with bright orange stripes and then a big black eye spot. And
nice. This seems to be a common factor.
Yeah, butterfly fish.
The big
fish
black
like
eye spot. Yeah. What kind of nutrition are corals giving off then? Obviously very high calcium for the bony plates ones, but what else can these fish be getting from corals? Why is it corals they're focusing on?
They have really high levels of protein and fat. So they've got, you know, they're nice and nutritious in that way, like a lot of calories out of one. And also you basically have your balanced meal there, because if they're eating photosynthetic corals, which most of these are tropical, so they are, you have your protein from the coral and then you have your vegetable matter from the algae. And the algae are also...
Look at them.
And the algae are great because they're also full of nice fats. So keep your butterfly fish chunky.
Yeah, a great balanced diet for the butterfly fish. So when we look at corals, and I don't like to use the phrase their job, because, you know, it's a very human, again, a human way of looking at it. But what do corals do for animals and the planet? What do they serve as a purpose, apart from obviously being predators and prey?
So corals, I'm going to focus on like tropical corals, like a coral reef, Great Barrier Reef here.
Cool.
For a minute.
Yeah.
Because that's where they seem to have the most functions. One, they're great food for other animals. Two, they make excellent shelter. All those branches, you get thousands and thousands and thousands of fish. The Great Barrier Reef is one of the places with the most species anywhere in the world. And it's not just species of coral. It's also species of fish and invertebrates and all the stuff that lives in there. Corals, in especially in tropical reefs, are really important for coastal defense. So they build these big mounds and it keeps coming up. And so if you go to the coast of Queensland, the water there is like, so the Great Barrier Reef is basically out to sea. You have to take a boat for a couple hours before you reach it. You can't just like drop in the water and go.
cool.
Also, you'd get eaten by a crocodile if you did that. So
there is that. Can we just remember that?
Yeah, Queensland is very sad because the beaches are perfect and they're full of crocodiles. But it's, the water there is flat. It's a mirror because there's no wave action coming in from the ocean because it's all getting broken up by the Great Barrier Reef.
Oh, okay.
So in Queensland,
that's an incredibly handy job for a reef to do.
It's really important. It's super important for island nations. So places like the Maldives or Malaysia or Indonesia, the protective effects of coral are incredibly important. And then finally, all these corals, especially the ones that create skeleton, are a carbon sink. So they take in calcium and carbon to make those skeletons, and then that carbon is trapped forever, basically, in a rock. It's not in our atmosphere.
So they're taking
anymore.
That out the water, and well, so it goes from sky to water to coral.
Exactly. And then the corals put it into a rock, and as long as they're still alive, that rock is stuck. And it doesn't dissolve back and release that carbon back into the atmosphere.
So although, like we said at the beginning, you know, there's that common misconception that they are plants, they are almost doing exactly the job that plants do, or trees do.
Yeah, they do a really similar job. They're basically like a tree to the ocean.
That's incredible. God, the corals do so much. I didn't know it was going to be as much as that.
Yeah, and they do different jobs in different climate zones. So in places like in the Arctic and Antarctic circles, there are lots of deep sea soft corals.
Yeah.
And they're really important nursery habitat for fishes that we like to eat.
Oh, wow.
So it's something we definitely want to make sure we, if you like having fish and chips, corals are something you got to keep safe. And they're super important for humans. Tropical communities, especially tropical island communities, often rely on coral reefs for a huge part of their livelihood. That's, you know, it's where you go fishing. It's where you get your food. It's where you make your money. You can make money on tourism. Make money on collection of corals for aquaria. They're just so important.
Do you know what? The more I hear about animals such as corals, and even if we look at different insects, it always comes down to that same thing of like, we need to protect them because they do so much more than anyone ever thinks, because they're at that basis of the beginning of life, really, you know, from plants and then to something to more mobile like a coral. We really have to start thinking about what these actually do, in order to appreciate them and save them, because like you said, it benefits us and so much more than just that coral. You mentioned a couple of places there. You said the Maldives, there was a couple of, obviously you've got Australia, but where can we find corals everywhere? Is there anywhere we can't find them, or can they pretty much exist in any kind of water?
They live in every country that's on the ocean and has deep water has corals. Doesn't matter if it's in the Arctic Circle. It doesn't matter if it's in the tropics. Tropics, you tend to get that band of really shallow corals with really dense populations. Deep sea corals tend to be, not always, but they are usually less dense And also definitely harder to get to, especially when they're down at, like, you know, 400 meters.
That makes sense.
But corals are basically, they've been found in any place that humans have gone and explored the ocean, there's a coral.
And I guess, like you said, with the tropics, I guess the reason why they have that big display more is, like you said, because of the sunlight. So they tend to be more hard corals, and it is that kind of, they can bloom there because the level of sunlight and photosynthesis?
Yeah, it's partially that, and partially that the climate is so stable. So that photosynthetic symbiosis is very, very delicate. So it only works in a certain range of temperatures. And you will find, you'll find corals that can exist out of that range. Like there's photosynthetic corals in Sydney that can handle temperatures of 16 degrees, which is pretty cold for photosynthesis. But you're not going to find huge aggregations of them. They're going to grow really slowly. Whereas in the tropics, you've got that perfect, like, it's always, you know, 22 to 27, and you get, like, maybe an extreme in one way or the other, but for the most part, you're in this, like, really beautiful range where that photosynthesis can work at optimum efficiency, and you get the most, like, the most out of it.
Okay, cool. That makes a lot of sense as well. And, like, talking of their delicate, like, relationship, the symbiosis relationships and the conditions that corals need. If we look globally about what is actually happening to corals, what is happening to them at the moment?
So there's been, humans are not great for corals in general.
Mm-hmm.
We could definitely be better. Global warming and climate change are definitely the most widespread threat to corals. Bleaching has had incredibly powerful negative impacts on coral reefs. We've lost a lot of our coral cover. And I think one of the misconceptions there is people think that maybe corals will go extinct, which is very unlikely. But what will happen is they'll stop performing all those services that we need them to, because they won't be able to live in those shallow areas anymore, and they'll only live in deeper water. So we won't have those massive aggregations where they're, you know, being homes to baby fish that we like to eat, and they're not storing carbon in the same, at the same levels that they were before. And, you know, they're not giving us that coastal defense that we need, and we start getting waves in places that we didn't used to have waves. Wow. It's definitely.
So it's more of a case of not necessarily losing the animal, it's losing the benefits and what they provide.
Exactly. Like the chances that one of those corals species is going to go extinct is very low, but the chances that we're going to lose all the benefits that we need from them is definitely high.
Wow, that's quite powerful from one animal as well. And do you think there's, this is quite a hard question, I think, but do you think there's time to save the coral reefs that we have now?
We're never going to get them to be the same as they were pre-bleaching, but we can have new, strong, resilient reefs that provide all the functions that we need them to provide and that animals need them to provide. So yeah, there's lots of hope. There's so many people who are working very hard to make sure that we can keep corals into the future and keep these reefs the way that nature intended them into the future. So definitely, there's a lot of hope right now.
And you mentioned there very quickly, and I guess I just realized this is something we haven't mentioned yet, is coral bleaching. To quickly touch on that, am I correct in saying that's when the polyps die off, but the bony plate is left behind?
So actually, the coral is, a bleached coral is still alive. What happens is as the temperature increases, the metabolism of the algae inside the coral starts going up. And one of the natural byproducts of metabolism are reactive oxygen species, which every weird health place has offered a cream or a supplement to reduce our reactive oxygen species. But what those are is it's just like a kind of, it's oxygen. Because oxygen can be pretty volatile. It can damage our cells if it's not in the correct form. So like O2 we breathe, it's not bad for us. But say ozone can damage our cells. Or hydrogen peroxide is also one of them.
Yes.
And you know, it bubbles up on you. It's not good for your, you wouldn't want to have that inside your body. So so these guys start making, these algae start making lots and lots of reactive oxygen species, which makes the coral think that there's something wrong with them, not just that they're, you know, on overdrive. And so they spit out all the algae. And so then the coral flesh itself is completely clear. And the reason for that is to let in as much sunlight as possible so that their algae can have as much, you know, as much fuel to work with as possible. So what you're seeing with coral bleaching is you're actually looking right through the coral flesh directly to the bright white coral skeleton.
Wow. I honestly thought that it was the corals that had died and the skeletons were left behind.
You can definitely see when they die. If you watch like a documentary like Chasing Coral, which will absolutely make you cry, they show kind of the transition. So you get those white corals that are still alive, but they're slowly starving because they use those algae for 90% of their nutrient intake. And they're still eating and they're trying to survive, but they can only go so long without the algae. And when they start to die, they start getting a different type of algae starts coming in. So you'll get like a fuzzy, green, slimy, gross algae that grows on top of the flesh.
Okay.
And that's basically, once that happens, that means the flesh is dead and it's starting to rot. So it's like having mold or something grow on something.
I'm just going to recap this because this is a really interesting point of the show for me, because I've just learned something completely completely new that I really didn't know. So when we see coral bleaching, it's the reaction of the polyps because of the oxygen or different types of oxygen being created. So they throw out the algae and then that loses their colour and we see straight through the flesh to the skeleton. And then that's kind of them starving, trying to find algae to live from.
Yeah, basically, if the water temperature stays high, they won't reabsorb. It takes a long time for an adult coral to reabsorb algae and start like growing it, in because they farm it, so they get it to split and divide inside their own bodies. But while the temperatures are high, that's not going to happen because any algae they bring in is going to have the same problem.
Yeah.
So if temperatures drop fast enough after a bleaching event, you can actually have every single coral live.
Wow, that's amazing.
But it does.
But I guess that's just so rare to happen.
Yeah, that it is. It's pretty rare. Usually, if there's an event that's bad enough that it bleaches a lot of coral, it also lasts long enough that it's going to cause some death.
I guess that's where the confusion has come from then, isn't it? Because 9 times out of 10, when the water temperature rises so much, it'll bleach. But like you said, it takes such a long process that we're going to lose probably a lot of that coral afterwards. So what then is left is just the skeletons.
Yeah, so you get a lot of that. And then those skeletons are no longer very structurally stable because immediately bacteria and algae and stuff start breaking it down. And then it gets brittle and it all comes down into like a big rubble field, which leads to a different problem, which is that rubble is really hard for new corals to settle on. Because as you can imagine, a big wave comes by and it'll just flip the, you know, if a larvae lands on a piece of rubble and then a big wave comes by and flips it upside down, that larvae is not going
to
make it.
And I guess that was going to be my next question then, to follow up on, you know, is there time to save them? But can we form new reefs? And I say we, I guess I mean that on two ways. Can we as people start, you know, giving space and maybe propagating new reefs? Or can the reefs, do you reckon, reform on their own?
Yes. So most places, so the ocean is connected by currents. And when corals spawn at one reef, all those baby corals that get put out into the water can get taken along the currents to the next reef and the next reef and the next reef. So as long as there's a current going by that can bring, you know, little baby corals back to a reef that's been through a bleaching event or has been mined or whatever has caused it to be degraded, then yeah, it can absolutely come back. The problems come when you have maybe really isolated reefs.
Yeah.
And then it usually requires some kind of human intervention to bring it back. And there are a lot of really cool restoration programs that are going on. And restoration is currently pretty contentious in the coral world. You've got people who think we should be working on restoration now, and people who think that we should put all our focus in preventing bleaching or preventing different kinds of... Because bleaching is not the only thing that's happening to corals. They've also got problems with, like, you know, getting run into by ships. Or people will mine the coral, especially the dead coral, because it makes those big, makes that rock, and it makes a good building material.
Oh, okay.
Which that's usually something that happens in areas where they don't have access to other building materials, so it's not so much a global problem as it is like a poverty problem.
Yeah, but yeah, it's more a localized, like you said, poverty problem rather than a global human problem. And I guess... To kind of sum up there, because we've kind of finished, well, nearly finished on like the issues with corals, but you said there's some great reef restoration projects there. Is there, for the listeners now, is there any organisations that they can kind of go to keep up to date with what's going on to reform or to support the global coral reefs?
Yeah, so there's Hope for Reefs, which is, I think, centred in Belize. which is a really amazing cool. program that people can check out. There's also in Australia, at the Australian Institute of Marine Science, there's a program called the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program, or RRAP. Cool. So if you Google RRAP and then AIMS, AIMS, you can get to the website for that. And they've got some really interesting stuff going. Local aquariums are often doing different breeding things and a lot of restoration. Like, that's part of what an aquarium's goals are, is usually some sort of conservation. Local aquariums, local to listeners, may not do corals in particular, but they'll do something usually in the local area.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a lot of resources for how to kind of see what progress is and how to get involved.
And to listeners, those two organizations that Rosie just mentioned, then I will put in the write-up of the show. So if you didn't catch them, don't worry, just look at the write-up and you'll see the links there. And Rosie, my last question to you, the Into the Wild question that everyone gets, is if you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone regarding the natural world, what would it be?
I would say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Something that one of my supervisors told me, which is to try things and don't worry if you're going to be perfect about it. Don't worry if it's going to come out well. Like, if you want to get involved in reef restoration programs, don't worry that you don't have every single qualification. Try anyway, because that's the only way we get ahead and learn things. And then the other advice that I was given in a similar vein, which is that anything that's worth doing is worth doing wrong, because if you do it wrong the first time, you'll learn how to do it correctly the next time. And that's how I've gotten through. I mean, I didn't grow up near the ocean. I didn't grow up doing any really marine things. I played in fish tanks. I did go to the beach for holidays and that sort of thing. But I wasn't, like, a lot of people think that to be in marine science, you have to have grown up on the coast of California or Sydney or Queensland, somewhere that you've got constant access to water. And that's absolutely not true. And so I've, you know, had a lot of things that went wrong the first time, but I've learned. So I think it's a really good...
That's a really cool bit of advice.
It's been a good motto for me.
Rosie, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I've learned so much about corals, especially my mind was blown at the coral bleaching bit. That's a real takeaway for me. So thank you so much for giving me this time to learn about these wonderful, wonderful animals and the variety of their looks and appearance and the jobs that they do and the purpose they serve as well. To yourself, I wish you the best for the rest of your time in your was it PhD you're doing?
Yeah, it is.
So you're in the final year, so good luck with all of that, and we'll keep in touch with you and look forward to speaking to you soon.
Thank you so much for having me. This was super fun. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work Rosie is working on, you can do so on Instagram and Twitter at Rosie Riots. Don't forget, you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether you just want to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.